A little idle chatter about the people that we know. And though it doesn't matter, is there a different way of saying hello?
You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit www.questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Good morning. Welcome to today's episode of The View. Today we will be talking about minister, religious educator, power dynamics. And our guest is Megan Henry. And before we introduce her and talk to her, let's go to our regulars. And I'm in Seattle.
Hi, I'm Joanna Fontaine Crawford, and I am here in Austin, Texas.
Good morning, everyone. This is Michael Tino, and I am joining you from Peekskill, New York.
Hello, everyone. This is Terry Bernor. I am in St. Paul, Minnesota. I will be live tweeting during our episode using the hashtag TheView, V-U-U. Hope you join the conversation.
And I think I forgot to say I'm Aisha Hauser. So if I did, I am Aisha Hauser. And Megan Henry serves on the Liberal Religious Educators Association board as the professional concerns portfolio. And that includes training good officers. So Megan, I would like for you to introduce yourself, say where you are, and a little bit about what good officers are. Because one of the things we'll be talking about is how Lareda trains their good officers and how we understand the Unitarian Universalist Ministers Association trains their good officers and the difference. So Megan.
Thanks, Aisha. Thank you, everyone. It's my pleasure to be here. So honored to be invited into this discussion. Yes, my name is Megan Henry. I'm located in Brooklyn, New York, and I'm actually finishing up my third year of my term on the Lareda board, and I've been serving with the portfolio that we actually changed the name from professional concerns to professional support. And in my role giving support, I do manage and train our good officers, and I oversee the Good Offices program for religious educators. I also am in contact with all of our Lareda chapter leadership teams in terms of support. So I'd have those two pieces are the main pieces of my portfolio. So after 3 years, I've learned a lot, and I'm really thankful for the opportunity to open this discussion to a wider group of folks to talk about some of the things that do seem to come up very regularly.
So I was trained as a good officer for the first time last fall with you. And one of the things that struck me, and one of the reasons why I was trained, is we kind of took a pulse and realized that for the last 2 years, we hadn't had a religious educator of color as part of our good offices folks. I thought it was an excellent training. And we not only talked about power dynamics, but also conflict between or challenges, conflict that arise between both the religious educator and the minister, religious educator and RE council and many. So let's talk a little bit about what you have lifted up as the most helpful part of the basics of the training based on what you hear from religious educators.
So I should probably explain.
Hold on one second. Maybe define what good officer is first. Thank you, Michael. Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit more about what a good officer is. So in our professional association, which supports religious educators, it's a membership organization of religious educators, ministers, UUA staff from around the continent. We are a continental organization, so we have members from Canada as well. So good officers are trained, experienced religious educators, and in some cases also ministers, who are there for our members to consult with when they run into sticky situations or they have questions about how to handle things that are coming up in their congregations or in their work. So for example, when I was a brand new full-time lifespan religious educator, moved, up from Knoxville to Virginia, working in a larger congregation, and my minister was resigned. And I'd only been there for about 3 months. And I was new to Lifespan work. I'd been a youth ministry professional before. So what I did was I luckily was a member of Laredo because the amazing interim, Barbara Stoddard, who had preceded me, had set me up to become a member of Laredo, to do all these trainings. Like, it was just really wonderful. So I knew to call a good officer, and I did. I called a good officer and I said, what do I do with my, you know, the minister is resigning. It's under duress. There is not a, like, there's potential division in the congregation. How do I talk to the children? What do I do? And so this good officer, who also is a religious educator and a minister, talked me through and gave me some suggestions based on her experience. So it could be something like that, or it could be like my RE counsel and I are having a disagreement and I need to talk it through. What are some good ways to handle this conflict? Because conflict isn't always bad. It definitely happens. How do we work through conflict? We have these productive outcomes. Things that I have encountered, the biggest thing that comes to good officers as a concern with religious educators that often doesn't end well is the fact that many religious educators are in systems in their congregations where they don't have a very much of a voice, authority, and power. And it's often they are supervised by the primary supervisor of all of the staff, who is oftentimes is the senior minister or the minister of the congregation. And many congregations no longer have personnel committees or HR committees. And I understand that for many folks, the reason that those went away was actually to protect the staff. That was a lot of the understanding of why, like, maybe these are volunteer committees and people don't really know what they're doing. And we need to have the staff protected and in a professional environment. Yes. So one of the things then that has happened is that there, if a religious educator or any other staff member for that matter comes into conflict with their supervisor, who often happens to be the minister, and they are not able to resolve that conflict on their own, there's often no recourse, nowhere for them to go to get help. Depending on the people involved, it can often and has been leading to a lot of resignations and firings of religious educators. So we're really seeing a need for a way to figure out how to work through some of these dynamics and create some positive systems for collaboration and ministry teams that are sharing power in ways differently. Maybe this is where we as Unitarian Universalists can be leaders in a countercultural movement to establish new ways of sharing power and working on collaborative teams. Or maybe we can adopt some old ways that we've forgotten about.
And I think it should be pointed out too that the UU Ministers Association, the UUMA, which is the Professional Association of Ministers, also has good officers. And ministers are expected to use those good officers, sometimes in similar ways to what you described, Megan. But mostly, good officers in the minister world get called in when there's either a conflict between or among ministers, or when there's a conflict between the minister and the congregation. Good officers come in and you know, a minister might say, you know, my board and I are not seeing eye to eye. Can you come in and help us work that out, for example? Or there's a conflict with the congregation and it might be headed towards a resignation of a minister. And so good officers come in and help that out too. This is a position that exists in several of our professional organizations. And I'm interested especially in how the Religious Educators Association and the ministers see those roles as similar and different, because there are some differences.
There's a great, Musicians Network also, thank you, Kim Sweeney, the UU Musicians Network also have good officers. And someone asked, would a good officer be accessible to a UU member if there's a problem with the DRE or minister? Now, what I'm going to speak to is something that happened to me where I was working with two ministers and there was severe tension. One of them actually yelled at me And I knew, because part of what I was experiencing was a diminishing of my role, because that's what I was feeling. So I contacted a UUMA good officer, because I said, okay, I don't think either of these ministers are going to listen to a non-ordained person. And that person actually said, I can't help you, that I can only work. Now, that person did reach out to the two ministers. And I realized, and one of the things I said to Megan after this training is, what would be helpful, because my understanding is, unless if there's a Lareda good officer who happens to be a minister, of course we can call those people. But what would be helpful is to have maybe a council or a group that are trained that could be called for either group, or even with musicians, like a collaborative group, because I do think it would be helpful for a minister to call a Lareda good officer with a religious, so that way they can be brought. I mean, I think it would be good if we could cross-pollinate. I think it would be helpful for the system.
Yes, absolutely. I really agree, Aisha. And we have been building relationships between, as more and more so over the last couple of years, between the different groups. So I've attended UUMA Good Officer training. The trainings happen a little bit, they happen differently and they happen less frequently than the Lareda Good Officer training, which happens twice a year. So we try to spread out the opportunities as much as possible, because we know that not everybody can get to every training. We've also started doing more online gathering using Zoom so that the good officers can be seeing one another face-to-face more frequently. And opening up communication so that, I mean, there is definitely obviously needs for confidentiality in these situations. However, I think that one of the downfalls of confidentiality becomes secrets. And that secrecy becomes a culture, problems occurring that we're not talking about because of confidentiality. So I do hope that the continued building relationship between UUMA, Lareda, UUMN, good offices, that keeps happening. And I think that it will, because we've started the groundwork there. Also, the UUAMP, the membership professionals, and the administrators professional group has also, they are working towards having good offices as well.
So I want to go to a dramatic example of this, because I think that it number one, it's a legitimate issue, but it's also something that I think kind of points to how power differentials can harm the church. What are the policies for a religious educator if you suspect that there is ministerial misconduct going on?
Wow. I Megan maybe can speak to that. I have not... in my case, the issue I had with my, with the minister I was working with, I could have really said it was misconduct and how abusive she was to me, but I was actually afraid to do that because it would have hurt my career. So Megan, can you speak more to that? Because that's what I've heard from religious educators.
Well, and I also want to take the conflict that is directly between a DRE and a minister for a second, take that aside and say, okay, so the situation is you suspect that the minister is doing something inappropriate with an adult member of the congregation, right? Because I think that this shows that this is the thing of, okay, this isn't about the DRE, but this is something that's hurting the congregation. And as ministers, this is a conversation we've been having for a long time about what do we do if we suspect this of another minister. Are there guidelines for the DRE?
There are not guidelines for the DRE for what to do in this situation. We call the UUA. We call our regional. We find out who we should talk to. I think that office at the UUA, blanking, what is it called? Misconduct. As far as I know, the only recourse or the only path that we have is to do something that anyone else would do, which is to contact that office, the Office of Ministerial Misconduct, person who holds that portfolio, to report it.
And potentially putting your job at risk.
Absolutely. It is very, yes. And so there are no protections in place for that kind of thing. I mean, I guess you could call it whistleblowing. You know, there's nothing for a staff member. And And honestly, it would, I think that it would be very frowned upon for someone a staff person in the congregation to do something like that. There's not, there's the Office of Misconduct, there's the Ethics and Safety. So it's something that we need to figure out. How can we create systems that enable folks to do this in a way that's not going to damage their careers?
We don't really have a good way. Okay, so here's the problem, the challenge, the reality of how there are institutional protections for our ordained clergy. Now, there's very, very good reasons for that. And I feel like the pendulum has swung so far. I don't know of any DRE, if we know there, I mean, it would have to genuinely be egregious. Frankly, way more than an affair, because a religious educator who needs their job, they know they're going to put themselves at risk with the regional staff, with the UUA. Hopefully that's going to start changing with how much folks are talking about power dynamics. But the system we have in place, I mean, think about last year's Berry Street lecture with Gail Seavey. Ministers were treated badly who tried to whistleblow, and there are protections for ministers. So I don't know how that would, I mean, I hear that, I think ideally in a world where we can hold each other accountable in love, even now with the, you know, white supremacy conversation, I've had white ministers say, well, you're just calling people out. And I said, actually, I don't know that holding people accountable or holding ourselves and our faith accountable is calling people out. So there is a resistance I have experienced by some ministers for anyone other than their peer, their colleague minister, or another ordained person to say anything. So I would actually like to hear from you and Michael about what you think that would look like and what your experiences have been.
Well, you know, it goes to back to what Megan was saying about secrecy and cultures of secrecy. And then a viewer actually participated in the live tweet conversation by saying secrecy is the culture of oppression. And it really is. I recommend to people, if you haven't read Gail Seavey's Berry Street lecture from last year, which talked about the lasting repercussions of ministerial misconduct, to read that. She was very bold in her truth-telling about ministerial misconduct and its lasting repercussions. But part of the reason why it has lasting repercussions is because of the secrecy. Because anyone who comes forward to say anything about it is shut down. And when it's someone who is in a staff position, a religious educator, for example, they can be shut down by being fired or having their professional reputation tarnished, because that's part of the power differential here, right? So if you like need your job to eat or like have housing, for example, there's extra pressure on you not to come forward and say anything.
Well, let me throw this in. Do we have a clear understanding about what the difference is between privacy and secrecy? Because like the issue of personnel matters is definitely a big part of this. We don't, you know, sometimes we have to explain to congregants, no, we're not going to make the yearly evaluation something public for all the members of the church to see. That's not fair to do to the staff member. Where's the line? I mean, obviously ministerial misconduct, pretty easy to peg that one, but where's the line between secrecy and privacy?
I wonder if it's about the nature of, it's a secret if it's, it depends on who it's protecting, would be my interpretation. Are we protecting the professional or the minister because of the culture of wanting to protect that person, the person who's been there a long time, or are we trying to protect a congregant, a person who should be protected because the power imbalance is there, right? The minister is the person who always needs to be, or the religious educator, the professional. So secrets are not good, as we know, secrets are not healthy for our systems. And it really is only, when we've had to let people go in our congregation, we do have a personnel committee and it's actually worked really, really well. We say to people, we've kept it confidential to protect the person who had to go. But if it involves someone else being harmed, I think there is value in saying, you know, we need to protect the congregation. I don't know. That's a good question. But I do want to, Joanna, you said something I want to get to about the DRE doesn't have the authority to save the church. And you're right about that. But whose authority is it to save the church? I mean, if there's a symbiotic relationship with a minister who's maybe not healthy for the church or the board, I mean, that's an interesting question. Like, what is saving the church mean, and who genuinely does have that authority? And I think that's an interesting question to explore.
Well, and how do we form teams that work in the best interest of the ministry of the congregation as a whole? I think that's really the underlying question, right? We have people tweeting up a storm here. So I want to just bring in some of those comments. Liz Roper let us know that there are many religious educators who have actually expressed fear for their jobs over insisting on participating in the white supremacy teach-in, but have been warned not to talk about that publicly. Again, secrecy and oppression and systems of oppression all playing into one another. I'm guessing that there are probably some ministers who are engaging in conflict with congregations over signing up for this this teach-in too. I know that it's been a little tense with me at times, and I'm working through it because, you know, that's what we do, right? Someone else says, don't many congregations have a safety policy that DREs can use and refer to? And I think that gets back to point about who you would go to if you suspected misconduct. And boy, safety policies are really good if you suspect misconduct from a volunteer. But you know, we're talking about power right now, right? Someone else says that the UU Society for Community Ministers, which has both lay and clergy members, also has good officers. Leah Purcell lets us know that with respect to safety policies, safe congregation policies, a religious educator would still be at risk for bringing things forward. And I think it's getting at some of these underlying power issues, right? Who's at risk for speaking hard truths and who's not?
Right. And and I just have to throw in, and this is a conversation happening in some other spheres too. Interns, you know, they're part of this, assistant or associate ministers.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that whenever someone is at the top of a pyramid and they hold all of the power, then that is a situation that is ripe for everyone under that person to be oppressed. And it doesn't have to be that way, though. Like, I would love to turn our conversation a little bit towards what some of the benefits are in working collaboratively in a ministerial team. I think that my experience has been so delightful with ministers who I have worked with. So I have these really amazing, wonderful experiences of collaborative ministry teams, of being involved in decision making, of being invited into that relationship in just such a lovely way that I really want to lift that up too. And also to share that I think that that's helpful for the minister also. Like, I think that ministers often feel very alone. And even if you have a lot of power, it doesn't, oftentimes that does make you very alone, right? And puts you in an awkward position as well. And so I want to suggest that working in collaborative teams where there is some power sharing and there are healthy covenants that are between those staff teams so that the covenant is not used in a way to silence, but so that the covenant is used in a way to authentically call ourselves into right relationship over and over again with some humility, then those kinds of relationships create these amazing teams, these amazing ministerial teams and worship teams that, and then the whole congregation benefits. I mean, this is who we are serving, right? We are here to serve these people and this faith. And we are part of it, but we are a part of it in a different way. And we are leaders. And for us to be engaged in modeling shared leadership and collaborative teams is something that is so beautiful for the congregation, because then they can take that into their committees. They can take it into their positions. Many of our congregants are, you know, powerful people who maybe supervise other people. Maybe they can see and learn from us. So I think we have a really wonderful opportunity to be prophetic leaders around this issue. And I see it happening. And it's so I want to encourage those who are doing it like this in this collaborative way to speak up and to talk about that and to talk about the benefits of it. Because other maybe ministers or leaders or whoever it is that doesn't have that kind of relationship to explore it further when they see how powerful it is and it's how beneficial it is for everyone.
Yeah, when we can break out of our silos, great stuff can happen. And I got to see this in a really unique way when I worked at First Houston, which is a multi-site congregation. And so back when I was there, the senior minister, Daniel O'Connell, would have a meeting, or we would have a meeting every week with all of the ministers and with the DRE who was there at the main location. And part of what we would be doing is whichever minister was going to be in the pulpit that Sunday would already have their sermon ready. And everyone, including the DRE, would look over it, give suggestions, argue at certain points about it, and it wound up with this really good product. And then the religious education was all a part of that as well. So it can happen, and exciting, creative things can happen.
But in order for it to happen, the ministers in the system have to realize and recognize and be explicit about their power in the system, right? So one of our viewers writes, unfortunately, some ministers have refused to be in covenant with a non-ordained person. And to me, that's like one of the most un-Unitarian Universalist things I've read in a long time. And, you know, that's kind of the point, right? That we have to be in covenant with one another, right? So I know that Tracy Brenneman, who's the religious educator I work with, who gave me permission to talk about our working relationship today, so I'm not speaking like out of turn or talking about her. She and I are very clear that that as the minister and as the full-time minister, especially she's a half-time religious educator in our congregation, I have more power in the system than she does. And part of my job then is to use my power in ways that lift up her ministry, right? And if we weren't explicit about that, then there'd be a problem. But we talk about that. And so I think that step one is you actually have to recognize that those power and be explicit about those power dynamics. Aisha?
Well, I wanted to lift up one of the things that that's changed in the congregation that I'm now in my fourth year. So when I started, it was very much a CEO, minister is the CEO, and there were actually two ministers. And now, and then both ministers left after 2 years. We went 9 months without any, and I'm a 500 member congregation. So it's a large congregation. We had no minister for 9 months. And then the interim came in and the DFO, the Director of Finance and Operations, and I worked to create we were the executive team instead of a CEO. And once the interim minister, Elaine, who's amazing, came in, she hadn't worked in that model where it was explicitly shared authority. So yes, part of her sphere is that she is chief of staff, and I am the director of lifelong learning, Jason's director of finance and operations, and the three of us are a three-member executive team that report to the board. And so it's been an interesting model because there's two other congregations that I know that do it, Beacon in Summit, New Jersey, and Jefferson, Eric Wickstrom, and Christina Rivera's church in Virginia, and Leah Derlin-Jones, where it's an explicit model of shared authority. And one of the questions we get is, well, what happens? Where does the buck stop? And so my answer is, because we're so used to this Eurocentric patriarchal model that the buck has to stop with one person, I said, well, it depends. Elaine is not going to, you know, overrule something on lifelong learning. If I have something going on with RE, that's going to be my sphere. I'm not going to overrule an operations decision, and neither is she. And I am not going to overrule, I mean, for lack of a better word, something having to do with worship or staff. So we have really discussed and worked through, still are working through, we're going to do a workshop on this at GA, how to explicitly change the dynamic of why does it have to be one person? And it has, and like you said, Megan, it is takes pressure off the minister. And Elaine Parislua is her name. She has spoken about this. I also recommend Salsa, Soul, and Spirit. it's a book about multicultural leadership dynamics or different ways of doing leadership. I think it'll serve us. The other thing about a minister refusing to covenant with non-ordained people, how is that person serving a church? Because as soon as you're called to a congregation, you're covenanting with a whole group of non-ordained people. So that already is a lot of red flags that any ordained person would, because then it's not about not covenanting with a non-ordained person. You just don't want to covenant with another professional who isn't. That's the dark side of how we've lifted up ordained clergy, is that we've almost, in some cases, I think some ministers see themselves as God rather than a person. That's been part of the difficulty. It's not just power. It's this almost a God complex that how dare you in any way. I've been around. Okay. It's a fascinating dynamic, and it's not one that is serving our faith well, because we don't sell heaven or hell. That's not our thing. I mean, I know that we have UU Christians, but in general, our theology is not about saying anyone who is ordained is necessarily closer to God. It is, you know, certainly folks who have a different connection to theology, certainly. However, for our theology doesn't say that person's somehow going to get me a ticket to the, you know, heaven. So I think that's something that's important to talk about.
So I saw a question about how do we encourage other ministers to engage in these kinds of models. And I know that there is, there was a team that created the task. It was a task force that made a report on shared ministry. And then there was another task force after that to look at resources for how to create collaborative leadership teams. There also is now a group that has put together an assessment tool for staff teams to use to look at how shared their leadership and how healthy their leadership teams are, how their staff teams are working together, which is something that's going to be shared at the professional days at GA. I think that there needs to be some sort of cultural shift from what you're talking about, Aisha, and I think that part of it is, this is so generalized, but there is something generational, not just that all young new ministers are collaborative team builders and all old ministers are not. That is not the case at all. We can't generalize in that way. However, I do wonder how much seminary and all of these things play into it, right? So over time, there can be a cultural shift based on teaching our seminarians how to do ministry and what's important and how it can be most effective to serve the faith in the congregations. I work with a seminarian student who's been doing her field education study from Union Seminary here. And I have, you know, this is something that we talk about. So we have supervisory meetings and we talk about what's different about this team, what this collaborative teamwork model. And I think that over time we can make changes, but that doesn't help the people who are in these situations right now, who are struggling, who are seeing inequities bearing out in their own employment situations when our congregations are fighting for justice outside of the congregation and saying we need fair employment practices for other people, but then not looking at the inside and what's happening in our own houses of worship and congregational systems.
And maybe I'm an old minister at this point, having been in this for 10 years now, but I didn't learn that in seminary. I didn't learn how to be a team builder or a team member. In seminary, I learned it doing young adult and campus ministry and doing anti-racism work, and noticing that religious educators were my strongest allies in that work. That's where I learned it. So there are lots of different ways that we learn it. And Terry has come out from behind the chalice.
Well, I just wanted to make a little plug for the changes that are happening in the formation process. And so I'm a candidate for ministry. I graduated from seminary 2 years ago, and I'm in the tail end of the whole credentialing process. And there's a whole new set of standards that new ministers coming in have to be accountable to. There's a whole brand new, completely turned upside down reading list that we have to go. And so speaking to what you're talking about, Michael, I think there is a recognition of new ways that incoming ministers need to be trained and to look at shared leadership, collaboration. The book that Aisha referenced earlier is on the reading list, and I don't think it was on the reading list before. And so if anything, my hope is that ministers that have been doing this for a while, maybe a little remedial work and take a look at what incoming ministers are being trained in, because sorry, you might be a little bit behind the curve in some of that stuff and might value a little bit of new materials. Just, you know, just a friendly collegial suggestion. I also want to say that the amount of chat and conversation that has been going on for this episode, I've been including and sharing some of this to our panel as we've been going along, but it has been a really rich conversation. We have 45 viewers watching this episode now, and it's great to see this. And I'm feeling just a little bit of a personal regret that this episode did not include more representatives of good officers across all the organizations. I personally had no idea that so many UU organizations have this. And it just does make me wonder, where is the opportunities for more collaboration and cross-population and pollination of ideas and training and relationships?
So speaking of formation, I have a question. The formation to become a religious educator is so profoundly different than the formation to become a fellowshipped, ordained UU minister, right? You know, with the minister, it's you do this, you do this, you do this, and at the very end of it, you're a minister. And with the, you know, religious educator, disclosure, my best friend, my best friend is Katie Cartman, who's a fabulous DRE at Emerson UU Church. But her formation was you become a DRE and then we'll figure out the rest of it, right? So at Live Oak, something that we've been doing, we've done with a couple of folks, is we have tried to create a formation program for people who want to become DREs. And it's kind of been custom to the people who were involved. With one person, it was more about discernment. The other one, though, just kind of happened. There was a member of a neighboring UU church, and the minister called me up and said, this is someone who is interested in exploring whether she might want to be a DRE and kind of try it out. And so she came in and as DRE intern was fabulous and is now hired at a third UU church. Are there any sort of formation programs that people are talking about or doing?
I think it's really, I would like to say that I think it's unfortunate that there's been such a Unitarian Universalist institutional devaluation of religious education as a profession and a calling. I think that we need our ministers to help us with this and to understand the value of what it is to have a religious educator who feels called to this work.
And who is not going to have everyone come up to them and say, so when are you going to become a minister?
Yeah,
that's what a pet peeve of someone I know.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what happens. As soon as we are very good at our job as religious educators, we are encouraged to become ministers. And for many of us, that is a really important path, because that's how we get paid to do the work that we're doing in a more fairly compensated way. I don't blame any religious educator who feels the call to go that direction for many reasons, being there, you know, as an important piece of the life transition, like a recognized, acknowledged person who is part of the life transitions within the life of a congregation and families and everything. I'm invited to be a part of child dedications and baby blessings. Not all religious educators are. Right. If I wasn't invited to be a part of those, I would become a minister so that I could do that. Right? So there's all these reasons why these kinds of disparities occur. But partially, I think because education is a feminized profession, like education of children and youth in our society, that means that in many cases, that was like religious educators have been treated is falling into a patriarchal hierarchical system that is very Western, and we're living in it. Long religious educators have been devalued in our congregations, that congregations hire someone who has no experience or is you, or is, you know, all of these different things that happen that bring people into the profession. And then many of them fall in love with it and are like, okay, I want to do this. I want to do this really well. How do I get formed? And so they enter into the credentialing process, or they take, you know, classes in education and education theory and developmental, you know, the local community college or wherever they can get it. But there is no formalized process other than our really amazing credentialing program. But it's not like you do that before you become a religious educator. It is on the job, and it's incredible. And I have not credentialed myself. I came into this wanting to be a religious educator, and I had studied world religions and education in college, and then got my graduate degree in philosophy and world religions, and did some education training and formation working as a youth ministry coordinator in a congregation. So I think many of us we all have our different paths to how we come to it. You're right, it's not the same as being called to being a minister and having a very clear path in that way.
One of the things that fascinates me about Unitarian Universalism is that for a faith that has a theology that I think is compelling and I experience as compelling, we're incredibly unimaginative when it comes to leadership. Like, we've simply taken a Calvinist, Puritan, Protestant model and just replicated that. And I don't know that it really serves us in the way that I think can empower folks to embrace our faith, right, more. So for me, I'm a social worker. I'm an MSW. Megan has I know many, 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 many religious educators that have master's degrees that are genuinely devalued because they're not MDivs. And so that to me is like, it's been a fascinating thing to feel like, well, there has to be some justification or some other thing other than being an educator. I mean, I know one religious educator who has a PhD in education, and somehow that's like not a thing which is fascinating to me. But religious educators come into the work either by, they have a pulse and the religious and the congregation needs a DRE or needs someone to lead the RE council. But what happens is our work is dependent on relationships with others. We need to recruit volunteers. We need to, you know, form relationships. They have to be safe volunteers. So we really have to get to know people. So the formation of a religious educator is rooted in the congregation. It can't be any other way, or the person won't really last that long. I mean, I know some cases where it does, but not really. It feels like I almost lament that the ministerial process is what I've heard even from Keith Cron is they have this phenomenon of folks will go to a UU church for a year, not having grown up UU, and then go to seminary. And then it's a very introspective process, which is fine. But then I'm like, so you don't, you know, you didn't have these connections that are external for many, many years and then become a minister. And so I wonder what that does and then how that affects the system. And I think it is important to look at formation for all of us. And I think Terry alluded to this, that the changes in the formation of ministers, which I'm happy to hear, because I do think it sounded, that was why I didn't do it, because I also got asked, finally people have stopped asking for the last 15 years, because it felt very introspective to me. I said, I don't really want to do all that reading about the Bible. I mean, I feel like there's more things I want to explore and strengthen my collaboration skills with other folks. And I think that's the part that I hope is being strengthened in ministerial formation, because we're not serving ourselves well in affirming patriarchy all the time. Does that make sense?
It makes sense to me. I want to lift up that Kathy Segal has added on our chat that an agreement for all professionals on best practices in shared ministry is soon to be unveiled. So the shared ministry assessment tool. So when we talk about that remedial education that that some of us need on how to do this teamwork, it seems like our professional associations are actually working on this. Megan, did you want to say something about that?
Yeah, we have been working on it. That's one of the things I wanted to just let y'all know, is that the professional organizations have been, my experience of Loretta and being on the board is that we are so hard to make these connections, to be connecting with UUMN, UUMA, and making all of bringing these groups together, right, and having these conversations and working on a shared covenant that we can all have some sort of agreement between the nations, which I think could be really incredible and a really great way to open this conversation even more. Last year, there was at the ministry day or like the professional days right before General Assembly, there was a really amazing workshop and conversation on shared ministry teams. And I mean, it was standing room only. There were ministers, religious educators, musicians, administrators, membership professionals. And it was really opened it up so that people were recognizing the need for this kind of work. And that will be some of that will be continued at the professional day this year. So yes, your associations are working hard on these things. And oftentimes, just like in our congregations, it's hard to get the word out, right? So the more we can be talking about these things like shared agreements and covenants, I think that the better it will be. But we do need to be talking to our colleagues about these things.
Someone asked the question about how this would work in small congregations. And it is true, if you're not working with a large staff team, the like dynamic is different. And even in a small congregation, I imagine a minister still needs to work collaboratively with the lay leadership. So the collaborative model is still important to lift up, I think, even with lay leadership, because you still need to have, one person isn't going to run even a 50, 60, 70 member church. So I am, you know, that's what I'm thinking. And it's about empowering each other to embrace this faith and live it out in the world. What do you guys think?
Well, as someone who serves a roughly 120 adult member congregation, I fit into that small congregation category. And I think that small congregations are places where we can, we can be experimenting with some of these new models and thinking about them. But I think part of the challenge in the small congregation is that people are often part-time. In very small part-time ministers, and in congregations the size of the one I serve, I'm full-time. I'm the only full-time staff person at the congregation, and the religious educator I work with, Tracy, is half-time, and nobody else works more than 3 hours a week. After Tracy, we have no administrator. So in some ways, that's a challenge, and in some ways, it's an opportunity, because Tracy and I are the ministry staff team, right? We are the team. And if I didn't see Tracy as part of the team that does ministry in the congregation, I'd be all by myself. It'd be me and the 3 hour a week bookkeeper. And, there's more of an opportunity there.
Yeah. Too. And I think especially and I saw this at my home congregation, for the churches that really, the small churches that really take on the idea of being leadership incubators, there's a real opportunity here. And if you do have a minister who says, yes, we are a leadership incubator, and part of the way that I can help someone become a professional DRE is to work collaboratively with them, for us to, and to have, a partner in what we're doing here.
Another challenge with small congregations that I just want to bring up is I've heard from some that they're not able to have, I think you might have said this, Michael, staff meetings. Everybody can't get together for a staff meeting if they're just like 5 hour, 6 hour, or 10 hour a week positions. Then you've got, it's very hard to have shared ministry when you're not all able to sit down and like talk about the worship service and have the music director or pianist be a part of that conversation. It can be very difficult. But also there's something else that folks had brought up that I just want to run back to really quickly, is this idea of congregations having safe congregations, relations teams, conflict teams in the congregations where people could potentially go to with issues that come up. Another piece of that is committees on ministry lift up the role of committee on ministry as being is to serve the ministry of the whole congregation, not just like a minister to go to. or to have conversations with, but for other people who are part of the ministry team to go to, which is, I mean, it happens differently in different congregations, I know, but that is another place where these kinds of concerns can be handled if the Committee on Ministry is speaking to the religious educator also, as well as the minister, as well as the other professionals in the congregation or staff in the congregation. And many congregations don't have those teams. Like there are plenty of congregations that don't have a right relations team or a conflict resolution team. I have found that many religious educators are left with no recourse when there is a conflict with the minister, that they go to the minister because the covenant says you have to go to the person you're having a concern with directly first. So they go, if you go to that person and that person happens to be also your supervisor and they say, I'm sorry, but I don't see it that way. And I need you to change your, there's nothing, there is no recourse. Reality right now of many of our lives in our congregations. And it's something for us to look deeply at and really discern around, is this the best way to be doing the ministry and engaging in our faith and in our principles?
Amen. It also, I do want to lift up that happens with associate ministers as well, who aren't, maybe if they're hired. So it's a dynamic that when one person has been deemed the CEO, it's a challenge in a church because we don't have the same kind of accountability. I do want to say that Marta Valentin pointed out that having part-timers work as a team is even more important because otherwise they, you know, feel like they're on their own. But that is something to look at, the importance of having whatever, however the system can support teamwork is important. And it's important for our society, right? Because that's also starting to break down. This has been an excellent show. We've had many viewers, and thank you, Megan. Thank you, Joanna. Thank you, Michael and Terry. Next week is Michael Crumpler, who joins us from the UUA to discuss his journey and his calling to LGBTQ and social justice. So thank you all very much, and I will see you next week.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.